The following podcast is a presentation of Sunridge Community Church.
We're kind of like there were the BC Lions this morning. You know, we're kind of the backup of the backup of the backup quarterback is finally here, you know. So hopefully I'll do better than Casey Printers because he kind of blew the game right at the end last night. Oh, we taped it. I was at church, actually. We meet, but then I taped it and I went home and was all excited. And then he threw. Oh, man. Anyway, here we are. I want to share a bit of my story. As Ray mentioned, just started a brand new church, lots into that. It's part of the Willow Park Church Network, so which is good when you're starting a church because it's always hard to get sort of that momentum, get that crowd together to get going. And so we started a couple of weeks ago. It's called The Abbey, and we're hoping to use our building. We have a building, the old Garden Valley building, to use that as a bit of an event center. So our sort of package, you want to look at our little theme thing, is, you know, we're the Abbey, a community of faith seeking to follow the ancient ways of Jesus in a modern context. And we're compelled by the love of Christ, led by the Spirit, guided by the Scriptures. So that's a bit of a mouthful. But I want to just tell you a bit of my own journey. My journey with church, my journey as I was a non-Christian until I was 27. And just how I've got to this place. And because I had became a Christian at the age of 27, and I was a truck driver, so my background, my wife and I are both from totally non-Christian kind of backgrounds. Had a friend that was a Christian, invited us to a number of things, and over a five-year period, I'm pretty slow before I got to the point to surrender my life and willing to make Jesus my Lord and my Savior and step into His kingdom and let Him rule my life. And a shock to me was that I sensed this call into ministry. I never wanted to be a pastor. Thought that was for people that wore polyester suits, and I didn't fit that role. So I never wanted to be a pastor, but just going through Bible college, ended up being a pastor. And working with Young Life part-time and pastoring part-time, and then went on to lead church. And actually, in the year 2000, became the pastor of Summerland Baptist Church, just down the road here, about half an hour. And things went well. Church grew, and things were going quite well. And then in 2003, for some strange reason, the denomination asked me to go to the Canadian Church Planting Conference in Vancouver. And I went to that conference, and my world changed. And it's taken probably 6 years till now to where I really feel that that beginning process of me relooking at church, relooking at Jesus, began back in 2003. At that conference, they had people like Eddie Gibbs, Leonard Sweet, just, you know, you probably don't know those names, but these people just really challenged us. And I can remember one of the first guys did the first day was he said, take out a Canadian, don't take it out, but if you have a Canadian $5 bill, and he said, read what's on the back of the Canadian $5 bill. Does anybody know offhand what's on the back of a Canadian $5 bill? I mean, it is small print. You need like a magnifying glass to read it. But on the back of a Canadian $5 bill is a picture of sort of an outdoor skating rink or a pond and some kids playing hockey. And if you can, you need a magnifying glass to read the fine print. It says this on the back of a Canadian $5 bill. The winters of my childhood were long, long seasons. We lived in three places, the school, the church, and the skating rink. But our real life was on the skating rink. And what this man pointed out, he says, folks, that is no longer our world. Kids growing up in Canada today do not live in those three places. They do spend a lot of their time at school and probably on the skating rink or in some kind of a sports field, but the church part is missing. And he said, we need to wake up to that fact. We still, in many ways, think about church and structure church like they did back when this was written for this on this Canadian $5 bill. He says, we live in a different world now. So if we're thinking of moving forward and planting new churches, if we're thinking of just mini-meing what we already have, then we're in trouble. And that started to really rattle my brain a little bit. And then what they did was they took us on buses to downtown Hastings Street, kind of the Skid Row area of Vancouver, to see some of these new sort of ministries that were evolving, new churches that were trying to reach out into that very poor, very tough neighborhood where drugs and you saw young girls that were involved in prostitution. And just was seeing some ministry that a church that had bought an old hotel and was renovating that, trying to reach out to the community and some other kind of coffee house kind of church things that we're trying to reach out. Some really neat, innovative ministries that were struggling along. But what struck me was downtown in that area, there was also some really big, old, established churches. You know those big, beautiful, old church buildings? And you could see people huddled sort of in the entranceway of these church buildings. You know, they have a sort of an overhang thing, and people were huddled there, but the doors were closed. As we're walking along with our tour guide, I said, what about these churches? What are they involved with? And the man said, you know, I hate to say it, but most of these churches are actually closed all week, but they open up Sunday for their worship service, and that's it. And that just struck me. Right outside their door was all this. The city had just grown darker, and this building that was supposed to be full of people that were light was just closed. And they gathered together on Sundays, and they came in, and they worshiped God, and then off they went home, and there was sort of this disconnection. And that really, really bothered me. I thought, how did these churches just get to that point? And then I went back to Summerland, and I was, like I say, at Summerland Baptist Church. If you've been to Summerland, right kind of at the end of Main Street, that's the three-story kind of building, Tudor style, was a new building we had there. Looked right out over the city, and my office is right up on the top floor. I remember sitting there the next week looking out, and I could see out in the park, right across the road, sort of, there's sort of Summerland, I don't know what it's called, City Park, or the park area there, and I could see kids in there smoking dope and doing drugs, and I thought, what's going on? Am I on the journey to become like one of those churches in downtown Vancouver? That's just sort of, doors are closed. And it really struck me, because I started thinking to myself, my whole life is surrounded in the church world. My whole life. I mean, we had a very busy church, and you're involved in committees and programs and the leadership board. And my whole week in a small group, a study home group that my wife and I led, I didn't have any non-Christian friends. I thought, what's happened to me? Just want to read a few verses out of the Gospel of Matthew, and because I started to rethink my own ministry and started to rethink and relook at who Jesus is and how Jesus did ministry. And it's a part of Matthew chapter 9, and it begins, or at least the heading of my Bible says, "Who needs a doctor?" But I want to skip down to verse 10. And Jesus has just called Matthew, this tax collector, to be part of his, part of one of the disciples. And it says this, "Later when Jesus was eating supper at Matthew's house with his close followers, a lot of disreputable characters came and joined them. When the Pharisees saw him keeping this kind of company, they had a fit and lit into Jesus and his followers. 'What kind of example is this, from your teacher? Eating and being cozy with crooks and riffraff.' Jesus, overhearing, shot back, 'Who needs a doctor, the healthy or the sick? Go figure out what the scripture means. I'm after mercy, not religion. I'm here to invite outsiders, not coddle insiders.'" I've been reading from the Message version, if you're wondering why that sounds so weird. But anyway, that's what I'm reading. So what happened there is I realized that, you know what, it didn't need to start by me getting up in front of the church and ranting and raving about stuff. It needed to start with me and my personal life. So my wife and I began a journey, and she played on a baseball team to really start to engage some of these people, to become their friends. It took about 2 years of making friendship, inviting them to our house for barbecues. We got to the point when we began evenings to just sort of have a barbecue and then have evenings to talk about life and God. And that developed into our small group Bible study, actually down the road of probably another year from the beginning of that. And I began to just really think about that Jesus, in many ways, pastored everywhere he went. Many times we think about, you know, sort of just doing sort of ministry stuff in the church, but everywhere Jesus went, he pastored. And it just started to change how I thought about what God had called me to as a pastor. But I want to just think a little bit. This was when Jesus came along, we see these Pharisees that are sort of pushing against Jesus, saying, "What are you doing? Why are you hanging out with these? Why are you trying to pastor all these people that we would consider unholy and so far out there? Why are you eating with them?" And you need to understand that in the New Testament time, the most intimate thing you could do is, I guess the same today, the most intimate thing we could ever do as human beings is sexual intercourse. But the second most intimate thing you could do in that culture was to eat with somebody. To put your feet under the table and eat with somebody meant you were really, really together. And Jesus is willing to sit down and eat with these people that the Pharisees and the religious people would consider very unholy. In other words, you're together with these people. How can you be a good rabbi? How can you be the Messiah and do that? They're wrestling with that. But Jesus does this. You see, and God is always at work preparing us for these kind of shifts in things. And see, John the Baptist had come along. Remember before Jesus? And he's standing out in the Jordan. Why is John the Baptist way out in the wilderness? Why doesn't he have his message right in the downtown Jerusalem someplace? But he's out on the edge of the country, out in the Jordan River, and he's calling people back out and saying, you need to make the road straight. The king is coming. The Messiah is coming. Change your life. And he's baptizing them. What John is really doing is, or God's calling, says, you guys need to come back out of the promised land, get baptized, and re-enter, because the kingdom is coming, and this is a huge shift. But of course, we see the Pharisees pushing against John the Baptist, and then Jesus comes along. They're just not getting it. But this is a huge, huge shift. Jesus sort of expanded this very, very radically, this idea of the temple being the center of everything. Everything being about, in other words, just pastoring kind of in a temple way. As one person said, the religious leaders of at the time of Jesus found Jesus very hard to house train. I love that kind of picture. Jesus clashed with a lot of their rules and regulations. John chapter 5, we see that guy who's been crippled for, is it 37 or 38 years? He's by the pool of Bethesda, I think is how you say it. And it's where the angel comes down and supposed to stir the water once in a while, and the first person into the water gets healed. And there's this guy that's been there for 37 or 38 years on his mat. He's crippled up. And Jesus comes along and has a conversation with him. He says, do you want to get well? He says, well, how can I? I'm all crippled up. And when the angel comes down and stirs the water, I'm unable to step in quick enough. And Jesus says, stand up and pick up your mat. And off he goes. And what happens right away? It's Sunday. It's the Sabbath. Jesus does this. And what do we find happening in that story? The guy goes walking along. He's got his mat that he's been laying on. And the Pharisees see this guy, and they go, hey, why are you carrying that mat? Because you couldn't carry the mat on the Sabbath. You see, these are all their temple-type rules. And the guy says, oh, I don't know. The guy that healed me told me to carry it. And all they can see is this guy's been crippled for 37 or 38 years. And all they can see is that he's carrying his mat. You can't carry a load on the Sabbath. Do you understand how crazy this is? And Jesus is purposely, he heals the guy. Why did Jesus tell him to pick up his mat? He purposely wants to rattle all this stuff. He's out there pastoring everybody. He touches his mat and he heals him. You see, the Pharisees, and when Jesus came, had this sort of idea that God wants to, it was sort of a very fenced in, very boxed in kind of a faith. And Jesus comes along and says what? I've come to set the captives free. He sort of, they've taken what God's all about and made it all these fences and all these rules and all these regulations. And Jesus comes along and says, I've come to set the captives free. What Jesus is, what we know is that, you see, and if you hear nothing else this morning, just listen to this, especially if you're here just exploring the faith. It is not God that will fence your life in. Sin fences our lives in. Sin makes our world small. When we steal, when we lie, when we get involved in all kinds of things that are outside God's plan, our life becomes smaller. Our life gets fenced in. And if people are really out there and can't control their behavior, where do they end up? In prison. And they're totally in a fenced-in world. But Jesus comes along and says, I've come to break you out of that stuff, to set you free. As the old theologian Augustine said, love God and do whatever you want. In other words, if you truly have a heart for God and love Him, you're free and you'll do the right thing. You will do the things that God is all about. So Jesus turns this right around. The second thing we see is even that Jesus is teaching, he's not just teaching truth in the synagogue. He stands up at the Sermon on the Mount. And who's there? It's like he's got this whole crowd in West Bank, a hodgepodge crowd of all kinds of people. And Jesus begins by talking about who's blessed. And the Pharisees think, those guys are blessed? The poor? All these kind of people? And then Jesus looks out at this crowd and says, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. These people, most of them aren't temple kind of people. They're probably a hodgepodge mixture of some are Jewish, some are Samaritans. Who knows what they are? It's like looking out at West Bank and looking at all the people and saying, you are the salt of the world. You are the light of the world. Jesus is sort of vision casting and saying, this is who you were meant to be. This is, he's pastoring, he's teaching all these people. This just rattles the Pharisees and gets them in all kinds of trouble. Jesus is constantly, everywhere he goes, the good shepherd is willing to leave the 99 and go to the one who's lost. He just pastors everywhere he goes, and we're called to do the same thing. You know, I was starting a new church. I thought, you know, I'm going to read through the Gospels and get all kinds of ideas on how to church plant. I found that very frustrating, to be honest. It started in Mark chapter 1. Jesus goes to Peter's house. His mother-in-law is sick. And he heals her. And then it ends up where there's this huge crowd all around in Matthew or Mark chapter 1. It's a huge crowd. He goes into the evening healing and teaching and all that kind of stuff. And then he's gone early. He's off praying. Remember, the disciples come and follow him. And they find him and say, hey, everybody at the house is waiting for you. Got this huge crowd there. And Jesus goes, what does Jesus say? Nah, we're going somewhere else to teach. Now think about that. If you're a church planter, what if I did the first week at the Abbey and we had a great crowd, everything went well, and then the next week I said, I'm not going there, guys. We're going to go over here. I mean, they would fire me. But Jesus just does things so differently. He heads off and he picks a leadership team that doesn't line up. You know, fishermen, tax collectors, zealot. They call some of these guys the sons of thunder. These are going to be the guys that he's calling to pastor. He kind of picks people that are on the fringe, that haven't sort of made it through the usual sort of way of becoming a rabbi or a teacher. I just read an interesting book about Patrick. You know Patrick that went to Ireland? The book said this. Patrick's troubles prepared him well for his mission. Though he had become devoted to Christ and the gospel, his heart longed to reach the barbarians beyond what they call the borders of civilization. It says, his lack of formal training contributed to his openness to new and effective methods. In other words, this guy was saying that one of the reasons why Patrick was successful in reaching Ireland is that he had missed sort of the Roman education system. See, because the story of Patrick, he was captured as a young boy in Britain and taken to Ireland as a slave. And through his sort of teenage into his early 20 years, when he should have been getting his training and education, he was a slave, working the fields as a shepherd for some barbarian kind of ruler in Ireland. And it's during that time that he became a believer. Then he managed to escape, get back to Great Britain. Then he had a vision and a dream that he's to go back to these barbarian people and bring the gospel to them. And he does. He goes back to Ireland. And this guy says that it's that he didn't have this formal training that made Patrick so successful. Jesus does the same thing. He picks these people to now expand and talk about the kingdom. People that aren't raised in the normal way. I mean, Jesus does things a pastor would never do. His friend Lazarus is sick and he dies. He's sick and I send for him and he doesn't come. And then Lazarus dies and then Jesus doesn't come for 4 days. Can you imagine as a pastor, you got to call someone who had passed away and you don't show up for 4 days? You would be so mad at that guy. So mad. But of course, Jesus has a bigger kingdom purpose. When he comes there, we know the story. He calls Lazarus out of the grave. But these people have to go through 4 days of agony and suffering. Why is our friend Jesus not coming? Why is our pastor not showing up? Because Jesus is this kingdom pastor. He's got, I think sometimes when we're in a tough spot, God does not come in instantly and release us from that because he has a bigger plan. I know some of the tough things that we have gone through as a family, that there's a bigger purpose happening. I don't fully understand it at times. I wish it wasn't that way, but it is. God has a kingdom purpose, and at times, he just can't reach in. I mean, it says that Jesus wept when he arrived and saw the pain in the family. I mean, I believe God at times goes, oh, I'd love to step in and straighten that out right now, but I can't. There's a bigger purpose. You see, the good shepherd is not just a church pastor, but he's the king of the kingdom, the pastor of the kingdom, and he calls you and I to pastor our communities. We are called to pastor our communities. As Reggie McNeil says, we've got to switch from looking at the kingdom through church glasses, take those off and put on kingdom glasses, and then look at the church. We need the church. We need together. I'm not saying we don't need, we need this. We desperately need these times to come together. But we have to understand that we are called to beyond these walls. And teaching people and pastoring people and living truth and being salt and light needs to happen everywhere we go. You know, Jesus in his teaching talks about the kingdom hundreds of times. He only mentions the church a few times. Jesus pastored in homes, on seashores, on long dusty roads, on mountainsides, at town gathering places like a well, around campfires. As another author said, Jesus was a Sunday school teacher that taught at the biker bar. Let me tell you a story. We've been working on our building, the Abbey, and trying to give it a new look, and just to kind of, it was painted, as the designer person said, very late 80s, early 90s apartment building, kind of the pinks and greens. So we had to give it a new paint job. And some of the neighbors have been coming over to say, you know, what are you doing? How's it going? And one of the guys is this old character called Don who lives next door to the church. And Don is like a chain-smoking, kind of a grouchy, swears like a chimney kind of a guy. And anyway, he has a fence that borderlines our property. And he says, can we get together and restain this fence? And it's kind of the last thing we wanted to do because we're busy now, you know, trying to get volunteers to get everything ready. But last thing, but Don, somewhere about three times, I said, okay, Don, Saturday morning we'll get the paint and we'll power wash it the night before and then we'll stain it. So anyway, we're doing that on Saturday morning, and Don makes us coffee at his house, and we're sitting on the back porch. This is about a month ago. And he says, so what are you guys doing in that building? You're opening the church, right? And we said, yeah. We tried to explain a bit of the vision to Don, you know, in ways that he'd understand. He says, we want to open the building up for other groups to do stuff with the community. He says to me, great. I'm retiring soon from, he works at Safeway. Can I have my retirement party there? And I said, well, that'd be the kind of thing that would be really good. He says, that'll be great. He says, then I can just stagger home and not have to drive. I'm thinking, okay, how do we pastor Don through this one here? So I talked to him. I said, Don, you know what? Let's talk about that a little bit. I said, I think, you know, God would want you to celebrate your retirement, your 65th birthday and your retirement. And I said, biblically, when they celebrated things, they would have a few toasts. They would do that. That's in the scriptures. But I said, to have a booze up is something that the scriptures tells us not to do. When we get drunk, we act like idiots. You can just look in our culture and see all the kinds of problems that people that get drunk, you know, issues there. He's going, I said, then, Don, let's think about this for a minute. You live next door to the church. Would you want us renting this place out for booze ups? So at 1 o'clock in the morning, you hear bottles being broken, you hear yelling and screaming, you hear people peeing everywhere. I mean, do you want to live next door to that? Don's like, oh, no, that's a good point, you know. So what I'm saying is that we had a chance to teach some truth to Don, to pastor him, to, you know, let him realize that, you know, that God does is a God that would like him to celebrate his 65th birthday and his retirement, to maybe have a few toasts, to have his family and have his friends. But God also says, Don, don't be a fool. Don't be an idiot. Don't get bombed. So it was a way to really take some truth and Pastor Don. It was a really great time, and all these kind of things were spinning in Dodds. Jesus even pastors the enemy. He calls us to love our enemy, and Jesus pastors his enemy. Even when he's being nailed to the cross, he's saying what? Father, forgive him. He's teaching forgiveness as he's dying. It's amazing. Jesus pastors everybody. In the States, there's these guys that did this thing called the Good News Tour, and they made this poster up. And it was really to get this point across that Jesus calls us to love the enemy. And in the poster was all the world leaders. You know, that was back when Tony Blair was the head guy in Great Britain, and Bush was the head guy in the States. And the German lady, I can't remember her name, but they were all on this poster. And Jesus is on his feet, or on his knees, washing their feet. And one of the people in the poster was Osama bin Laden. And boy, did this cause a controversy in the U.S. They were just, no way would Jesus ever love and show and serve Osama bin Laden. And that poster got banned, and it caused all kinds of things. And, you know, we just didn't realize that Jesus isn't just the church Jesus, isn't just an American Jesus. He's the king. And he talks about his kingdom. And he wants to pasture the kingdom. And we need to be about doing the same thing. One of the guys that went through this kind of shift, and I need to probably get winding up here before you guys all fall asleep, was John Wesley, the guy who started the church called the Methodists. John Wesley was actually an Anglican man who really felt that they needed to get out of the church and start pastoring the bigger community. I mean, him and George Whitefield would actually go and where the coal miners were changing their shifts to go into the coal mines, they would hold sort of an open-air church service right outside in the field, outside the coal mines, and it is said that these coal miners that were black from working down the coal, you could see these as the tears came down. I mean, God was just moving. They had a heart to sort of pastor everybody. But see, in an Anglican system, that was difficult. Because to even hold any kind of a service, to even speak in a church, the Anglican system in Great Britain is all divided into parishes. Certain, like West Bank would be a certain parish. And if I wanted to sort of, I was an Anglican minister and wanted to have a service here and we were Anglican, I'd have to get permission from the bishop to actually be able to come and be able to speak and hold a service in one of the Anglican churches. But John Wesley was struck. He found that he wasn't getting allowed permission. So, you know, they said, oh, no. And he said, well, I'll schedule a different time. Doesn't it interfere with any other services? Nope. So finally, out of frustration, it says he stood on his father's grave one day and said, the world is my parish. And that was the beginning of when he started to move out to do all those open-air gatherings and with the coal miners and all kinds of places. John Wesley had this heart that he knew that Jesus was about the kingdom, and he wanted to pastor all people. Because the world that John Wesley was living in, the Anglican world, had become so entrenched to Jesus was just about sort of this church, and it was all this hierarchy stuff, and people were missing it. I want to tell you a story. When I was at this thing, and what really struck me is I was at this conference in Vancouver back in 2003, and we got taken down to Hastings Street to the poor area, and I told you that we saw these little fledgling church plants and church ministries trying to reach out to the poor and the broken, and I saw those churches that were closed, that were just having no connection or no impact in that area at all. But one thing happened as we were heading back to our buses. They had taken us down by these coaches. There was two coaches, so it was about 80 people. We're all on this tour. We're walking along. And we get to this intersection, and we're stopped at a light, and this black man comes rollerblading along, you know, only like a guy who's black can do. And he stops at the light ahead of right at the crosswalk there, and he looks at us and he sees like 80 people that look like out of place for East Hastings Street, right? And he says, what are you guys doing here? And we said, well, we're kind of pastors and people thinking about church plants, so we're down here to have a look. And he says, oh, yeah, let's sing. So here we are in downtown Vancouver in the Hastings Street area at this crosswalk waiting for the light to turn green. And this guy on rollerblades starts leading us in Amazing Grace. I mean, he's got rhythm. He's got the arms. I have no talent for singing. He's got his thing in Amazing Grace. He is just doing this unbelievable stuff. And we're singing. There's 80 people singing, and other people in the street are starting to join in. And it was just like one of those moments where you just sense the Spirit of God. Like, just, it was just, didn't seem weird at all to be singing Amazing Grace in downtown in the Hastings Street area of Vancouver. And at the end of the song, I was just like, I was moved. I was just, you know, one of those sort of, I'm not an emotional guy. I'm actually British, so I don't have any emotions. But, you know, I was moved, and I went over to the guy, and I put my arm around him, and I said, man, I said, that was amazing. I said, I could see you leading a choir in church someday. And he said to me, look around. And he says, I said, yeah. He says, this is church. This is church. And it just struck me that my world had really become all about pastoring in the building, in what we call the church. And I needed to understand that it needed to be both. We need to come together and grow together and learn together and pastor each other. But you and I, if we stepped into the kingdom to make this world human again, to fulfill the dream of God and his kingdom, need to pastor everywhere we go. Let me pray, and then the worship team is going to lead us.